UK Wine Show, show number 187 for the 18th of December 2009. Guy Tresnant on branding UK wine. Hello and good day to you all. My name's Chris Scott and welcome to the one and only UK Wine Show. As a week that's had some exciting revelations that Chardonnay's dad is not a white van man from Essex, we've got a fantastic show in store. I've finished all my tastings for the year, and now I've got a week of coding, DIY, and doing all my Christmas present shopping. Hopefully you'll find this week's show nice and easy. In the interview, we're going to be talking with Guy Tresnan about branding UK wines, and in the spotlight, we have an overview on blending. This is going to be a part one of two parts. And for our mystery grape or region, we've changed it this week to a mystery wine producer. I think I signaled that last week. So next up, we're going to have our first clue to our mystery wine producer. The second clue would be just before the interview, and I'm going to give you the answers to it at the end of the show. Our mystery producer is a négociant known for its Burgundies. The family have been involved in wine since the 17th century, slowly building up a domain of 50 hectares growing Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. The vineyards extend from Jamberton in the north to Chevalier-Montrocher in the south and include over 28 hectares of Grand Cru, making it one of the largest Grand Cru domains in Côte d'Or. The grapes from all these vineyards are vinified and aged in their Chateau Courton Grancy winery in Courton. This was the first purpose-built winery in France and uses a railway system with elevators to allow the entire winemaking process to be achieved by gravity assistance, designed to eliminate the threat of oxidation from pumping up the must. Okay, I'm going to give you a significantly more easy clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Another Italian wine scandal is erupting, this time involving around 10 million litres of Tuscan wine that the Italian authorities suspect may have been blended illegally. Italy's Treasury Department and the Italian Agricultural Ministry are investigating quantities of current release wine that may have been made using wines of inferior quality not allowed by appellation regulations. These include wines from Chianti DOCG, Toscana IGT, Brunella di Montalcino and Rosso di Montalcino. 17 people and 42 companies are involved.
While illegal blending of wines has been common in Europe for many years, I do think it's ironic that it's only been when Europe's foisted their appellation system on the rest of the world that the rest of the world has said, you need to follow your own rules. Not necessarily in this case, but extra diligence from the authorities is almost certainly associated with the personal assurance Italian Prime Minister Mr. Toothy, or Toothless Berlusconi, had to give to the US on the Brunello scandal earlier this year. I still think a lot of rules on countries that tend to ignore their own rules will always lead to scandals. Foisting an appellation control system on the rest of the world has made it stark that Europe has a lot of work to do to ensure the integrity of their own appellation control system. Whether it's the odd couple of hundred tons of sugar, as in Beaujolais, or the illegal blending of wines, Europe has had more wine scandals than anywhere else because it has more rules than anybody else and more people who ignore them. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, Hong Kong has overtaken London as the second biggest wine auction market after New York. Sales in 2009 totaled 543 million Hong Kong dollars, that's 70 million US dollars, and accounted for about 25% of wine sales in Hong Kong. In London, wine auction sales totaled 34 million US dollars, but New York is by far the biggest market at 135 million US dollars. That's according to estimates by Gilles Lempert-Schwartz, executive consultant to auction house Acker, Merrill & Condit. In Hong Kong, the lifting of all wine taxes in February 2008 spurred demand for wine and created an auction market from nothing. In 2007, no wine auctions had been held in Hong Kong, and the only auction houses present were Christie's and Sotheby's, dealing in fine art. Since then, wine auctions have been held by both of these houses, and new companies have entered the market, including Zakis, Acker, Merrill & Condit, and Bonhams.
Well, we'll see if Hong Kong holds onto its crown when European recession is over. Hong Kong is not going to supply wines to the rest of the world. No one is going to ship fine wine to Hong Kong, auction it, and then ship it back. So, London is the natural hub for Europe, and advantageously located next to key fine wine producers, as well as being quite a sophisticated wine market. Hong Kong is best positioned for North Asia and New York for the Americas. It's as simple as that. The volume of the wines will reflect the economies in these areas. What's the last story, Jane?
A study has identified the maternal parent of leading grape varieties is a grape once banned in parts of Europe because of its poor quality. The grape is Gouet Blanc, which was widely planted in France in the Middle Ages and is mother to Chardonnay, Gamay, Aligoté, Auxerrois, Bâché, Franc Noir, Melon, Romorantin and Sassy. Some grapes you've probably not heard of before. Scientists already knew that a number of modern-day grapes resulted from spontaneous crosses between Pinot Noir and Gouet Blanc, but this study using DNA analysis by the universities of Cambridge and Stanford pinpointed the latter as the maternal parent of 9 of 12 varieties. The Oxford Companion of Wine describes Gouet as a light-skinned variety producing very ordinary acid wine. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website 3050.co.uk.
The significance of the new paper is that it identifies which variety provided the pollen, the father, and which one was the mother in the vine crossing, or at least 12 of those that were studied. The authors address this by examining chiroplasty DNA. Chiroplasts are a little bit like mitochondria, which originates from the DNA of the parents. Like mitochondria, chiroplasts come from the mother, not the father, in offspring. So you can track down which side was the mother and which side was the father. This means that the way the crossing occurs is important. The characteristics of the mother are just a little bit more important than the father. And interestingly, the main parent for the 9 out of the 12 crossings was Gouet. And that included Chardonnay as well. So the most important grape variety in Chardonnay is a rather acidic, uninspiring wine. Okay, next up though, we have our spotlight. This week we're looking at blending wines. The question is, why do winemakers blend wines? It's often for quality, price, style, and volume. And they're all true, but behind them is the word synergy, the magic ingredient in blending. Synergy is the idea that the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. For example, human beings are synergy. We are more than just a collection of atoms. Blending allows winemakers to make better wines than the grapes by themselves would normally allow. For example, blending Cabernet Sauvignon, which often has strong acidic and tannin structure, with a softer, more rounded Merlot, creates a full-bodied, round wine. The combination is more pleasurable than either of the wines by themselves. Other classic combinations include Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc, where Sauvignon Blanc provides the acidic backbone to complement Semillon's fullness. Some blends are purely for economic reasons. For example, if a variety is particularly fashionable and another variety unfashionable, you may want to blend the two together. But just be aware, like all food labelling, the order of the grapes on the bottle is important. So, for example, a Sauvignon Blanc Chardonnay has more Sauvignon Blanc than Chardonnay. And also, if there's less than, say, 15% Chardonnay in the wine, then it doesn't even need to appear on the label. So you could have a wine that's 85% Sauvignon Blanc, 15% Chardonnay, and the wine will just say Sauvignon Blanc. Some wines are simply best as blending partners. For example, Grenache is a high-yielding grape that achieves high sugar levels, but at the cost of colour and low tannins. So in Australia and the Rhone Valley, it's blended with Shiraz / Syrah, and here the Syrah provides colour and tannins, filling the gap. Mourvèdre is another good blending component with Grenache, again providing tannins and colour, with Grenache, Syrah and Mourvèdre all combined to create the classic Rhone blend, also known in Australia as GSM. In Spain, Grenache is often partnered with Tempranillo to give it more structure. So Grenache is quite a good base wine because of its high productivity, but just needs a blending component to fill it out. But it needs another wine to give it more tannins and structure. Something of interest is that Châteauneuf-du-Pape has 13 varieties authorized to make the wine, which is a powerful, little richly coloured wine. But not all grapes are red. Similarly, Chianti in the famous Tuscan region uses the red wine Sangiovese to blend with the white wine Trebbiano. So you don't need to necessarily blend white wines with white wines or red wines with red wines. You can mix it up. I'm going to continue blending on the 8th of January. It's quite a ways away, isn't it? But we're going to be looking at things like non-vintage blending and all sorts of other types of blending. Okay, let's get on with the show. We've got our mystery producer next. And unusually for such an old company, the name of the head is also the name of the top company. This negotiant is a large exporter with shipping companies, with a shipping company that was established in 1797 and is based in Bonn, and today exports to over 60 countries worldwide. It's unique in Burgundy that it's still family owner run, having passed down for over 10 generations. On the company's bicentenary in 1997, the company head was given membership to the Hennekens Club, that only admits companies that are leaders in their respective fields, remain family owned, have a history of over 200 years of experience, and still bear the name of the founder. To date, there are 30 companies around the world that are members. Now, you do see their wines in shops all around the UK, so they're quite common, and the company's head has been on the UK wine show a couple of times, so that might give you a clue. If you are looking for their wines, which I'll give you the answer after the interview, you may come across Chapel Down Wines. They're a leading UK producer and probably the top still wine producer in the UK. And they make some pretty tidy sparklers as well. They have a number of sub-brands around, such as Tenterden Vineyards. And in the past, they've made wines for a number of UK producers. But as they evolve, they're doing less of this. In this week's interview, we talk with Guy Tresnam from Chapel Down about Chapel Down Wines and how they're changing their branding. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm here with Guy Tresnam from Chapel Down. How are you, Guy?
I'm good, Chris.
Should I call you Chapel Down or English Wine Producers?
Chapel Down is good because people recognise that as the brand, which is part of why we're talking, I guess.
Okay. What we're going to be talking about today, as you very slickly linked into, was we're going to be talking about
English... Chapel Down the brand.
Chapel Down.
Wow. See, I'm on a fiver every time I mention it.
Maybe we should have a drink every time we get it in there.
No, worries.
No, we won't be doing that.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about brands and wine brands and all cool. That sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's been a few years since we've interviewed you guys. I think I interviewed Owen, show number three, Owen Elias, the winemaker there. So I wouldn't mind just doing a quick catch-up on what's happening in the last 3 years, because when I spoke to Owen, you guys were planting a mass of grapes.
Yes. Yeah, well, we are. We still have the way we operate, Chris, is we're not dissimilar in style to a Champagne region in that we own vineyards ourselves and we also have partner growers. And the partner growers who joined us maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago are now beginning to see the benefits of growing grapes rather than winter wheat. The returns are far higher for them. And farmers, as you know, are pretty land rich, a lot of them, and are saying, well, look, the 20 acres that I put over as a trial, I'd now like to put over another 50 acres or 60 acres. So we have no issue with land. That's great. That's the first thing, which is great news. Secondly, we need to be aware that all our eggs in one basket in terms of everybody else producing for us could be a bit tricky long term. So we're also planting ourselves. And our model will ideally be that we would own 25 to 30% of the land ourselves, and the other 70% would be by partners. So last year we bought a 100-acre plot on the Downs just outside of Maidstone in Kent, mm-hmm. and it's solid chalk. It's just beautiful. It's more champagne than champagne. It's just fantastic. In fact, it's adjacent to a chalk pit. Which had just been dug out. It's just wonderful land. We planted 80 acres of it. And one of the other changes since you last spoke to Owen in Programme 3, I think it was, is that we have a viticulture expert, Craig Daly, who joined us from Central Otago. He's from New Zealand.
Oh, I'm from Otago.
Cracking, well, you need to meet.
Nice bloke.
Well, the problem is with these Central Otago fellows, they're a bit dodgy, you know what I'm saying. But no, he's a really great bloke, and he studied in Australia, studied viticulture, just top man. So he's brought a different level of viticulture to both our existing partners, our existing vineyards, and indeed our new plantings. And if I'd love for you to come up and see the new planting. It's laid out beautifully. There's something like 14 clones on Pinot Noir, 12 clones on Chardonnay. I think we got a bit of Meunier up there, but it's all beautifully laid out. And what that will do is when we start to bear the fruits literally, is it starts to add more complexity to wine, and the link between the winemaker and the grape growing becomes even more important for us, where maybe that wasn't something that we focused on before. Mm-hmm. So when it came to harvest, we were getting the grapes in, and Owen was doing a great job making world-class wines. Now the grape grower is saying, well, you know, if we take some of those grapes and some of those grapes and we start blending those together, it's adding more complexities to our wine, which is got to be good for the brand, I think.
Is Craig getting involved with the farmers as well?
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. He's advising them and showing them. You know, before where we had the site at Tenterden, we could bring farmers down and say, almost like a franchise, and we act as the franchisor, this is the way you need to do it, now off you go. What we do now is Craig visits those farmers and says, look, this is the way I want it done. I'll help you. I'll bring my team in. We'll work with you. We'll show you the best results. And, you know, one of the funniest stories I can tell you, and it's not something that our finance director will like me telling you, but can you imagine a situation where a viticulture expert is going to a farmer and saying, actually, you see that bunch of grapes there? Chop them off. Put them on the floor. And we go, what? How much are we going to lose? And he's explaining that, no, look, this is about getting the most nutrients out of the ground to feed these two bunches rather than these four, because you're just going to get so much better wine, and in the end you're going to get a better result.
Yeah, green harvest.
And, yeah, absolutely. It's something we hadn't done to any great extent before. And, you know, when a finance director's looking at it and go, how much are those grapes on the floor? He sees the end result being a good result, so it's not an issue.
Yeah, okay. We're going to get on to branding, but the growers that you've got, do they get their own wines made, or is it
some and some? Some are just out and out farmers that want the best money they can get for their crop, and that's straightforward. You know, as long as the quality is right, and we have contracts with them that sets out the standards. As long as they meet those standards, then we pay them what we pay them, and that's what they do. Some will say, "Look, I have whatever it is." 10 tons, 10 acres, whatever, I would like to sell you half of it, and I'd like to do a deal where you make me some wine. So we do that as well. But that's not really commercially available wine. It may be wine that's sold from a farm shop or a, you know, it's good, but you're not going to see it in a restaurant. It's very small quantities.
The wine quality in this won't necessarily be bad. It's just that distribution is different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'll be, some of it will be pressed and made in the same way as ours, but it's just hived off separately and then sent back.
Let's talk a wee bit about branding, because you guys sell wine, and I've seen your wines under different guises in different places. I've seen a brand called Primrose Hill. Mm-hmm. I've tried some of your rosé from Primrose Hill.
Right.
It's sold by a company called Bibendum, who are a merchant in the UK, and they sell it to some of the restaurants. And we were talking earlier, you also say you've sold wine to Marks and Sparks in the end.
Yes, this is our second year for selling wines to Marks and Spencers. The reason we'll do that is Marks and Spencers are, as you know, it's all about the Marks and Spencers brand. And you reverted earlier on to Primrose Hill. Primrose Hill was a brand that Bibendum, the merchant, wanted to develop to represent their history, their background, their ethos, their heritage, if you like. We have to be careful that building brands that aren't Chapel Down has really no value for us as a long-term project.
It's short-term cash flow issues.
It may have done, and we may have maybe even as little as a year ago said, well, okay, we've got an opportunity to make 40,000 bottles for somebody. It doesn't have the Chapel Down brand on. Let's do it because the cash flow might be important to us. Thankfully, we're not in that situation now. However, we would still like to work with the right people. Marks and Spencer's, no doubt, is the right person. So what we've done with Marks and Spencers for this second year, and we're doing four wines this year with Marks and Spencers rather than three last year, and it's two sparklers, a white and a pink, and two still wines, a white and a pink, is we're co-branding. So we have the Marks and Spencers logo for their English wine offering, which is a George and the Dragon. But then at the bottom of the label, it's clearly marked Tenterden, England, and it says made exclusively by Chapel Down. Now, Tenterden, England is very, very important for us because it's giving an identity to English wine. If you think of Champagne, people say, I go to the Champagne region. Some people say, I go to Epernay. Some people say, I go to Rheims. It's a location that people understand. And we think if we can start to develop Tenterden, England as the home, if you like, of English wine, that's what we're looking to do. So anybody that we're making wines for now, we need to be sure that, one, it's the right commercial partner and is representing and being shown in the right places where we'd want our wines to be. And secondly, we need to know that there's enough on the label that people will understand Chapel Down. And actually, in the longer term, that's a great benefit for our retail partner as well. Because if we have a PR machine that works very well for us and it's talking about Chapel Down as the brand and as the winemaker and as the experience, and by the way, they also make the Marks and Spencer's wine that you can go in and you can see the Chapel Down branding on, then there's already an association for the consumer. If Marks and Spencer's PR are wanting to develop a story about Marks and Spencer's English wine, they're from a standing start. There's already a link now with Chapel Down as the leading commercial producer, as we are. So it has to be beneficial to both.
Now, obviously, Bert, Tinton is where you guys are based.
Yes.
How many other vineyards are based in Tinton or around that area? Stanlake Park's not too far away.
Stanlake Park's nowhere near us. Biddenden is just around the corner, but that's in Biddenden.
And there's Leeds Castle.
There's Leeds Castle, yeah, and that's about 7 or 8 miles up the road.
Yep.
But you know, we are the biggest. We produce more bottles than anybody else, and we think we should have a home, and people should recognise the home. We do some consumer events. We show at the Taste of London exhibition in Regent's Park, and more and more people are coming to the show each year and saying, I've visited Tinton. We want that to be a centre of excellence. We have a fantastic restaurant that is run by a Michelin-starred chef, which totally represents our brand 100%. We have a visitor experience, I'd like to say, second to none. If you want to bring your granny, who's 80, or if you want a corporate experience where you can see the winemaking team working, you can see state-of-the-art machinery, you can taste from a tank if you want to, you can practice sabirage, taking the top of a cork off with a grenadier's sword. You can experience all of that sort of thing, and that's got to be a worthwhile experience. And it's a model that you'll find in California or Otago or Australia. We don't really have that tourism side in England yet, because maybe some of the vineyards are still too small for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'll happen in 4 or 5 years' time, I'm sure. But we want to be ahead of the game and be seen as the centre of excellence. And in association with that, the plan is to have an education facility on the site as well. So we're currently discussing with an agricultural college about having a facility on site where the students come down, can work in the morning, and then out in the fields in the afternoon.
Your vineyard, not your vineyard, your winemaking is, when I'd had a look around about 3 years ago, nice stainless steel tanks, but it was in an old barn and it wasn't exactly state of the art. Mm-hmm. In terms of the environment. I'm sure you don't need a flash building to make a nice wine, but...
Speak to the winemaking team, they'll tell you they need a flash building. I think it's, to be honest, Chris, it's about the machinery and the knowledge and how to use it. If it is in an old barn, which it isn't, by the way.
It used to be.
It might have used to be, but it's not anymore.
Yeah.
And we're also developing a new winery over the next 3 years.
Oh, okay.
Our challenge is we're in what's called an area of outstanding natural beauty. So planning consents are tricky. And obviously the economy is tricky. So, you know, go to a bank and ask them to lend you £2 million to build a new winery right now. You're not going to get a great response. However, we think we can produce something that's pretty special without having to put ourselves into too much hawk.
Mike Roberts from Ridgeview, he has the concept of what he thinks the English sparkling wine should be as a brand. He likes the idea of Merrett, after Christopher Merrett, the man who first discovered sparkling wine production in England. You're not jumping on that bandwagon. You think you should be positioning as a Tinton versus that sort of thing?
No, we're actually talking with Mike about this Merrett mark.
Yeah?
Yeah, we are.
And what's the discussion?
I think we need to have more discussions. And then,
I can see a few bottles being drunk while you're discussing these.
Why not? It gets much easier to negotiate when you've had a few bottles. No, it's. I think it's a great opportunity. It's just how that mark is used and who's able to use it and what the criteria and what the standards are. And I think if we can find a level that suits Mike, first of all, because obviously it's his brand in inverted commas. But I think it could be a good steer for the industry, definitely.
There needs to be some sort of name that defines English sparkling wine. And I personally don't think Tinton, because it's too geographical, would be it. Might be that.
But this isn't defining the wine, this is defining where you need to be going. It's not about seeing Merrett as a Merrett to me would represent a standard, a quality standard. And you could say, well, to get that merit, it needs to be noble grapes, or it needs to be selling at £25, or it needs to be in 10 on trade, or it needs to be in whatever the criteria that are set, you need, that's what needs to be agreed. And that's, I think, what's being discussed at the moment. Tented in England is about a location that people can focus on. Because don't forget, we export as well. So it's not just about people in this country who may or may not have heard of Tenterden. But when you're talking to a buyer in Hong Kong or a buyer in Japan or a buyer in US, Tenterden England becomes even more important because it gives a home.
In terms of what regions, though, like England has quality standards that define different regions, etc. Mm. And those regions are defined either as a quality wine or a regional wine. And the regional wine is normally by the county, for example, Kent. So how does Tenterden fit within that sort of framework? Because it doesn't really fit within what has already defined it.
Okay. What I can give you is the best way to maybe try and clarify it. We have our vineyards in three counties. We have vineyards in Essex, Kent and Sussex. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that locality or regionality, we're quite diverse. We're across that whole southeast of England. Yep. If you look at a top branded a piece of apparel, if you talk about a Ralph Lauren, for instance, very often next to Ralph Lauren you'll see New York. Very often next to Pucci you'll see Milan. Very often next to Tommy Hilfiger you might see San Francisco. You'll see a location, an association that is a backup for the consumer in terms of its quality. If you saw David Smith trousers and they came from Peckham, you might go, that's not really got the ring I want to it. We want Tenterden, England to be recognised as a centre of excellence for the production of English wine.
Even if the wines don't come from that region?
Well, it doesn't matter where the grapes come from. It's all made there. That's our home.
Okay, that raises an interesting point, because some people do think that where the grapes are grown is the most important thing rather than the winemaking, whereas you're more of a winemaking philosophy as opposed to a...
At the end of the day, we want to make world-class wines. Now, if our grapes are sourced from 24 vineyards and they all go into the same bottle, unlikely, but you know, it's about producing world-class Chapel Down wines, you know. And you know, this is quite an interesting discussion, because if you're talking about regionality, and I'm aware that there are some regions that are making wines that are sourcing grapes that are nowhere near their region. Now, do I have a problem with that? No, I probably don't, because they're still making good wines, and they're representing English winemaking.
Okay. What about exports? You mentioned exports earlier.
Yeah.
There's a big volume coming on stream in the next year or two in terms of not only your planting, but lots of other people's planting.
Absolutely.
And whilst English people like their fizz, and maybe they're not drinking as much champagne due to the recession now, you're going to need to find another market apart from England.
I think there's a couple of things there. First of all, on the champagne side, and it's a great opportunity to get my dig in on champagne. Champagne clearly represents, and this is not from me, this is from my customers, clearly represents the excesses that have got us into the trouble that we're in now. That and bankers. That's about it. That's the economy simply wrapped up. Bankers and champagne. There you go. In all seriousness, people are saying to me, particularly caterers are saying, a lot of their customers are saying, actually, we don't want a Grand Marc champagne because it does represent what's not really, we're not comfortable with it at the moment. Yeah. Let's have something that's homegrown. Let's have something that's... So the market in the domestic market here is enormous. It has enormous potential. If you put all of the English wine producers together, I think the latest figure is 0.03% of the UK's consumption of wine. It's tiny. So we have massive growth potential in the domestic market. However, that is at a learning curve for both us as a producer and the consumer. The opportunities also exist for export for a number of reasons. Anything coming from England, generally considered by Americans or Japanese, one is good quality and two is expensive. Now, I'm happy with both of those because we are good quality and I'm happy to be expensive. So we currently export to Japan. We currently export to Hong Kong. And we're just scratching the surface. And we are very happy with early discussions that are going on with some US possibilities. And we think we found a very good partner. And, you know, when they say, look, we're not going to be taking 20 containers from you in the first year, I'm sort of saying, yeah, that's cool.
That's good.
I'm happy with that. But we need to find the right partner. We don't want a wine importer in the States who has, you know, that covers 30 states, has 500 salesmen, and has a wine list of 1,000 wines.
I don't think there is a person like that in the States.
What a southern, how far does southern stretch? Maybe. What the point I'm making is we need somebody that's got 5 or 6 states, the right sort of states, the right sales team, that have a history of bringing in wines from other countries, marketing them properly, selling them properly, getting them in the right place at the right price, which is exactly what we've done here. And we think we may be some way to doing that. So for us, definitely, even though 95% of our sales are currently domestic market, we need to know that when more and more of our production comes on stream, as it will do next year, year after, 2012, 2013, we start getting into serious numbers, we've already laid those foundations for export. So okay. That's what we're doing now.
So you see the US market and Hong Kong as your two big markets?
I think Japan is potentially bigger than Hong Kong, but certainly the US has massive potential for us.
Okay.
It's that special relationship between our two countries.
The English talk about the Americans go, who, what?
All I need to do is go over and wear a bowler hat and get on the Jay Leno show and we're made.
I know you
say... One day Chris Scott, the next day Jay Leno. There
yeah,
you go.
Yeah, I know. But who's got the better audience?
You have Chris. That rustling, listeners, is the fiver Chris has just passed over.
Excellent. Okay, then, Guy, I think we'll wrap it up there.
No problems.
Thank you very much
You're
for your
more
time.
Than welcome.
Thanks, cheers, Chris. Mate.
Cheers, bye.
It's been a while since we've had Chappell Down on the show. I think it was show number 3 with the winemaker Owen Elias on the show. We're almost finished now, but next week's show is due out on Christmas Day. So instead of putting a whole big show together, I'm not. But what I am going to release is I record an interview for the International Wine and Spirit Competition about 3 months ago about their green debate. And I'll be releasing that on Christmas Day as that week's show. So do stay tuned for that. The next full and proper show will be coming out on the 1st of January, 2010. So hangover material, perhaps. Right, let's finish up the show, though. What was the mystery producer? It was, of course, negotiant Louis Latour. Here are the clues again. Maison Louis Latour is a family-run producer and negotiant known for its Burgundies. The family has been involved in wine since the 17th century, slowly building up the domain to 50 hectares, growing Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. The vineyards extend from Chambertin in the north to Gevalier-Montrachet in the south, and include over 28 hectares of Grand Cru, making it one of the largest Grand Cru domains in Côte d'Or. The grapes of all the Louis Latour vineyards are vinified in Château Courton-Crancy winery, and this was the first purpose-built winery in France, and uses a winery systems with elevators to allow the entire winemaking process to be achieved by gravity, designed to eliminate the threat of oxidation from pumping the must. Louis Latour's shipping company was established in 1797 and is based in Beaune, and today exports to over 60 countries in the world. It's unique in Burgundy that it's still family-owned and run, having been passed down over 10 generations. On the company's bicentenary in 1997, Louis Latour was giving membership to the Hennequin's Club, that only admits companies that are leaders in their respective fields, remain family-owned, and have a history of over 200 years' experience, and still bear the name of the founder. To date, there are only around 30 companies around the world that are members. As a long-established business in Burgundy, Louis Latour has pioneered the production of fine wines from outside Burgundy. All right, that pretty much ends this week's show. The week we found out the parents of Chardonnay. So let's finish up with a quote about parents. Well, sort of. This week's quote comes from one of the great fathers, who probably knew all his children. After all, he wasn't a family business. It was said by Vito Corleone in The Godfather. I like to drink wine more than I used to. Well, that's my best Marlowe Brando attempt. Until next week, have a really good Christmas and cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.